From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we have a firsthand account of what it's like to be a COVID-19 survivor in Milwaukee. Then, Wisconsin school districts are starting to craft their budgets for the upcoming year. But doing that in the middle of a pandemic is challenging.
We know the impact has been very swift and severe. You know, that's raising a question about whether the state might need to freeze or cut school aids to try and manage its own budget problems.
And then we talk about how the coronavirus has reawakened some long-standing debates on the nature of our government.
Democracy isn't just about voting. It's not just about aggregating preferences. It's about discussion with one another to generate a conception of a common good.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the U.S. has over 1 million total cases of COVID-19. In Wisconsin, the cumulative number of cases is over 8,500. A global pandemic and numbers like these can be a little hard to grasp, until coronavirus affects you or someone you know directly. For us here at WUWM, our former staff member Danielle Nelson was that someone. Danielle is a healthy 37-year-old woman with no pre-existing conditions who was seemingly at a low risk for contracting coronavirus. However, what started as chest pains she initially dismissed escalated to getting hospitalized with COVID-19. She joins me now to share her story in the hope that others can connect with it and learn from her experience. Danielle begins by explaining when she initially started feeling unwell.
Yeah, so I started having chest pain around probably March 12th or 13th. And I didn't really think too much of it because these are crazy times we're living in. And I thought it was just anxiety. And so I kind of shrugged it off. But then on March 16th, I started feeling a little off in the morning. And then by the evening, I had a kind of a full-on fever. And so I pretty much did not leave my bed for the next several days until the afternoon of March 19th, when I ended up going to the ER to get tested. It was a really brief visit. They gave me a prescription for albuterol to help with breathing, which at the time I didn't need. So I went home, went immediately back to bed, and then, you know, really kind of took a turn for the worse. And so it got to the point where, you know, it was really hard to walk. I was resisting the urge to crawl, you know, to get around the house. So in the later afternoon of March 24th, I ended up going back to the ER and then was there until the 29th and then was back home and have been recovering from home since March 29th.
So before you went to the ER that first time to get tested, were you on the phone with a doctor and the recommendation was to go and get tested? Was it a difficult thing to get testing? Because that is kind of an inconsistent thing right now throughout the country is testing availability.
Yeah, I think maybe for the area, I was maybe ahead of the curve. So, you know, there was no wait in the emergency room. I was in and out in 15 minutes and I didn't call anyone ahead of time. I just had a feeling and my fever was kind of all over the place while I was in bed from, you know, it'd be 99 and then it spiked at 104. So I knew that I just really was not well and I shouldn't have a fever for that many days in a row. So I just went to the ER.
Right. And you are, you know, a young, healthy person, no pre-existing conditions, no history of smoking, nothing like that. It was unexpected, right?
Completely. Yeah. I mean, when I look at the list of, you know, folks or conditions that might put me more at risk, I don't meet any of them. And so it was another reason I kind of looked past the chest pain initially, just because I thought, you know, I shouldn't really be at risk, you know, so maybe I could worry a little bit less. But that was obviously my mistake.
Well, and there's a lot of information being bombarded at us. So by the time you're admitted into the hospital, and this was before any tests came back positive or negative, correct?
Right.
So what was your experience like to be a COVID patient inside the hospital?
Being in the hospital with COVID was really scary and really isolating because, as you probably know, no one's allowed into the hospital. And so I was there by myself. And, you know, I've been messaging with someone on Facebook who is in the hospital now with COVID in a different part of the country. And she kind of compared it to being a zoo animal. and when I read that, I choked up because that was really my experience as well. You know, understandably, doctors and nurses are afraid. And I felt that very much so. And just having that limited contact was really scary when you're, you know, spending so much time alone with your thoughts.
So no visitors outside of medical staff coming in to check on you. You're isolated. Medical staff are covered head to toe in PPE. You know, were there certain things they tried to do to help you feel more comfortable and less intimidated? Or is everyone just as overwhelmed by everything?
Well, I think, again, I think because it seems like I was there kind of on the front end of people getting COVID here, there was a lot still being sorted out. And I think folks hadn't quite adjusted to the new normal. And so everyone was so nice to me, of course, and very professional. But, you know, just being another human being, I can pick up on people's anxiety. And it's scary and hard to be the diseased one that everyone's afraid of when I'm afraid of myself as well.
Yeah. So how were you feeling, you know, levels of pain and stress physically feeling during the days you're at the hospital? I understand you didn't need a ventilator. You were having some difficulties coughing and those kind of symptoms, but you didn't need to be intubated, fortunately.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really grateful for that. I did receive oxygen. And, you know, I think the thing I'm learning about COVID is that there's really a lot of ups and downs. And that was true for me in the hospital as well. I'd have, you know, times where I just, you know, I couldn't even make it to the bathroom by myself without calling someone in to help me. And I really wasn't able to eat. And, you know, and then, you know, of course, being in a hospital, it's hard to sleep anyway, but, you know, having difficulties sleeping. But then, of course, there were moments that were a little bit easier. And certainly, you know, by the end, I felt like, you know, I was ready to go home, even though I wasn't even sure I was ready to go home. I was scared to go home. And even now being at home, there's good days and bad days still.
Were there any misconceptions about the disease that you had that made you maybe waiting for certain things to happen to you or feel while you were in the hospital because you heard of other people going through it and it was kind of in those initial stages?
Yeah, well, because, you know, it started out just as some chest pain, and then it was kind of just a fever, and then it was a sore throat. You know, I kept worrying that it was going to get worse and worse and that I would end up on a ventilator. And so, because so many people do, and you hear about the shortages of ventilators. And so I'm really just so grateful that I ended up not having to get to that point, but definitely those thoughts were the ones that were keeping me up at night.
Yeah. And in your first Facebook post that you shared, sharing your story and that you were positive, you wrote about a moment that you prepared to say your goodbyes to your fiance and your mom. And I mean, I can't imagine that, but how was it to feel the need to do that, to feel like this might be the lowest point, this might be the end in a life that people assume has so much more to go?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's hard to go back to that moment because, I just love life and I feel like there's so much more that I want to do. And I think reflecting back now, it gives me a lot more empathy for other people who are in those moments, because it's sad and it's scary, especially being there alone and not being able to really touch anyone and touch the people I love and tell them in person that I love them. You know, I kept getting worse. And I kept thinking, this, I can only get worse for so long. And I was, you know, hooked up to heart monitors. And when I went into the hospital, I was really dehydrated and had super low blood pressure. And so it's not that I wasn't hopeful that I would get better, but my body wasn't getting better. And it was causing me to worry.
Did you have that same amount of worry when you first had to go back to the ER to be admitted? Did you think this could be the last time I see this person?
No, I didn't at that moment, because honestly, I was so out of it. You know, I couldn't even get myself out of the car. I was put into a wheelchair. And then it's almost like I hardly remember even that those first, you know, that first night in the hospital. So I was so out of it. I wasn't even really thinking about anything. I was mostly sleeping.
In the moments when you were awake and thinking and concerned and noticing how your body was feeling, in what ways did you try to cope with the pain? Did you find activities or thoughts or things that kind of helped you?
So I had a meditation app that I used, and that helped a little bit just to really help me focus on breathing and not panicking. I completely stopped listening to the news and went off social media and really tried to not look at anything about COVID-19, just because there's so much bad news and it would just cause more anxiety. And then I watched the movie Julie and Julia about 4 or 5 times when I was in the hospital, because I was hoping it would spark a desire to eat. Because that was a big issue, is I just did not have an appetite and I only wanted to eat sugary things. And, you know, it didn't work, but it's a great movie. And now I know all the lines.
Yeah, it'll be a movie forever changed for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you able to FaceTime with your family, friends? Did you have the energy to?
No, and I did a little bit, but again, I was so out of it, you know, most of the time, and, you know, just kind of dealing with my own demons, it was hard. And I know that, you know, I wasn't looking very good. And, you know, just in that I looked really sick and weak, and, you know, I didn't want to scare my friends and family any more than they already were. So I, you know, mostly texting.
So what was the turning point where the doctors were telling you, like, okay, it looks like you can be discharged pretty soon?
Yeah, so I got several chest x-rays when I was there because, of course, I had the pneumonia in my lungs. And the last morning, they did a final chest x-ray, and it wasn't 100%, but it was well enough where they thought, you know, maybe I'm over the hump. And so they sent me home with some breathing exercises and, you know, with not necessarily medication besides some cough medicine, but, you know, just the doctor's orders to take it easy and stay hydrated.
So you've been out of the hospital and are now technically cleared of that isolation period post-hospital. You know, you can leave your home, but how has your body felt since being released?
So just now I'm starting to feel a little bit back to normal, you know, in my body. I'm still tired. I still take a nap every day, which I had never done before. And now it kind of there's a still lingering feeling in my chest. And I kind of compare it to like going to a bonfire and maybe inhaling too much smoke and feeling it the next day, that kind of crackly, achy feeling in your chest. That's kind of how it feels. And some days are better than others.
So what concerns you the most being a survivor of COVID-19, but not really having any concrete answers?
I'm terrified of infecting someone else. You know, the thing that has been the most frustrating about having COVID is just how nobody knows anything. And people you expect to have the answers, like doctors, like health, public health officials, there's so much that they don't know. And so, you know, I've been cleared. They say that I'm not contagious, but now that I have a little bit of doubt in my mind, and I'm, you know, just mentally a little bit anxious about that risk, because of course the last thing I want to do is hurt anyone.
Why did you decide to share your story first initially online through your Facebook and now with us?
Yeah, well, so I wrote this Facebook post, and originally, you know, I had just written it to friends, and then, you know, my mom asked if she could share it on her Facebook page. So, you know, you do what your mom wants. So I made it public, and all of a sudden, you know, it just kind of blew up, and I think it's been shared like over 30,000 times now. And it's kind of shocking. But when I wrote it, you know, I had just gotten home, and, or, you know, that week, and I still was feeling so horrible. I was sleeping most of the day, and I felt so lonely. And, you know, I didn't really know anyone else who had the same kind of symptoms, or who had had it quite as bad as I had gotten it, or who had been in the hospital. And so, you know, I think thinking about it now, I wanted to tell all my friends that this happened to me. But also I wanted to share my story because I wanted others to know that they weren't alone, that there was someone out there who had, you know, a similar experience. And I kind of wanted to put myself out there. And that actually since has really helped, I think, in my recovery, helped me feel less alone, less isolated, which is, you know, why I made a website so that people could kind of gather there. And I've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks responding to messages through Messenger, through the blog, just with people who are in the hospital, who are at home recovering and just feeling scared. And I feel scared too.
Have they been asking you any common questions that, you know, we haven't already touched upon in our conversation? Because I'm, like you said, there's so much unknown. And even as you are recovering and released, you don't know if you're immune, you don't know what life is going to look like going forward necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people ask about the medications I received in the hospital. People are asking about, in general, how I'm doing. I think it helps people to know that there are people who get COVID who go to the hospital and recover and survive. And so, you know, people just generally checking in on me. And then, you know, just kind of getting a sense of my timeline and when they can expect to feel better. And from my own kind of messaging with people, a lot of folks are saying, you know, it's about taking them about 7 weeks to really feel like themselves again. And I'm not there yet, but I plan to have a little party by myself here in my house when that moment comes.
Well, and your story is helping others, but I think what you've seen, what a lot of people are seeing, is that it affects everyone differently. How important is that point to hit home, that this is your version, you know, of COVID? It might not be exactly the same.
Oh, for sure. I mean, everybody's different, but there are some things that there seem to be trends in my little corner of the world with the folks I've talked with, and, you know, small things like not being able to taste anything, to just kind of a shared understanding of this kind of ongoing feeling in your chest several weeks later, and just kind of the lingering anxiety that, you know, nobody wants to hurt anybody, and just having so many people be so afraid of us and whether we're contagious or not.
Yeah, how are you trying to take care of yourself now and post-recovery?
Yeah, everyone tells me I need to keep drinking water. So I'm trying to do that and stay hydrated. I'm a little bit tired of hearing that, actually. and, you know, I like to walk my dogs around the block, you know, just that kind of basic recentering stuff that I think can help everyone. But, you know, so many people have reached out to me with such kind things to say and kind of hopes for my recovery. And that has helped me. And, you know, I had someone, kind of an acquaintance friend from my alma mater, McAllister College, reach out to me, and who's an art therapist. And so I've been doing some art therapy sessions over video. And that has been really helpful, just to kind of regroup after just feeling like I'm on another planet for the last 6 weeks or whatever.
So what's your call to action for everyone listening now and moving forward as many places across the U.S. and around the world continue with extensions for safer at home orders?
I've thought a lot about this. And, you know, this is why I called my website Better by Each Other, because I think this whole situation with COVID has made me realize how connected we are and how much we can impact each other. And how also how we can just do a little bit better by each other. And so maybe that's, you know, wearing a mask, even though it's uncomfortable and it's not perfect. Or maybe that's, you know, wearing gloves or not going to the grocery store today and just eating that macaroni that you have in your pantry instead. Those little things, they have a ripple effect. And I think the more we can do better by each other, the better off we're going to be during this pandemic and the stronger communities we're going to have.
Since you've been home and having this experience, do you think that people aren't taking it as seriously as it should be warranted? Because they maybe don't have the connection, they don't know someone who's had it, and all they're seeing is the news of the worst of it, New York or other things, and it's numbers, it's not connection.
Yeah, I think with anything, hearing personal stories helps people understand things in a new way, which, you know, from that Facebook post that I had, I've been contacted by a lot of different news organizations to do an interview. And I haven't really wanted to, just because I don't necessarily want to be the face of COVID in Wisconsin. But, you know, I chose to do this one because I'm a public radio nerd. And also because I think it is important for people to hear that someone actually has experienced COVID right down the street from them in Stallus. And I think, you know, that stories are what connect people to each other and I think make it more real for people. And, you know, a little bit, I'm hoping that's what my kind of opening up about my experience will do.
You mentioned Better by Each Other, which is the name of your website and how people have been reaching you. So with that regard, going through these messages you're receiving, how far do they extend? And what have been some of the most impactful or memorable things that have stuck out to you?
You know, the thing that amazes me is how this Facebook post and the website are just getting out to people kind of all over the world. And it's kind of amazing how we're having, in some ways, this very shared experience. And while, you know, everybody's different, there are some similar kind of trends in the people who are messaging me about their recovery, about their fears, about their anxieties. So I've been trying to kind of take what I hear and put these in blog posts just as a way for people who are recovering from home or who are in the hospital can just go there and know that other people have had some of their experiences and to know that they're not alone in this crazy experience that they're having.
Well, Danielle Nelson, I'm sure all these people in Tenfold are very grateful for you sharing your experience and continuing to help others through it, recovery and beyond. And I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us. It means a lot.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone who's reached out to me and has really helped with my recovery as well.
Danielle Nelson is a COVID-19 survivor who lives in West Dallas. You can find a link to her website, Better by Each Other, at WUWM.com. After the break, the Wisconsin Policy Forum looks at the dire budget situation Wisconsin schools are facing. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The COVID-19 crisis could significantly deplete state resources in Wisconsin. Governor Tony Evers says the state could lose more than $2 billion over the next year. That's because tax collections are expected to drop and demand for state services like Medicaid are expected to rise. This is bad news for school districts, which are heavily reliant on state funding. In fact, K-12 schools are the largest expense in the state budget every year. The Wisconsin Policy Forum has a new report about how school district finances could be impacted by the pandemic. Research Director Jason Stein spoke with WUWM education reporter Emily Files about the uphill battle Wisconsin schools will be facing.
So I guess the way that I would describe it is there are just a whole series of unknowns that school leaders face as they're trying to put together their budgets. And, you know, they're just doing preliminary budgets right now, but they're also making some really consequential decisions like hiring and contracting with teachers. And so it's a difficult situation that they face as they're trying to plan a year out right now at a time when we have so much uncertainty about what's going to happen even a few weeks from now.
So Governor Evers and Republican lawmakers struck a deal in 2019 to increase school funding by about $570 million over 2 years. And the upcoming year was supposed to be a good one for school districts. They were supposed to get a higher level of special education reimbursement and more spending power per student. So what might happen to that expected state funding increase now?
That's a great question. You know, school aids are state government's single biggest expense. And, you know, we don't know how badly state government has been affected by tax collections falling in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic, but we know the impact has been very swift and severe. And so, you know, that's raising a question about whether the state might need to freeze or cut school aids to try and manage its own budget problems. But it's really hard to predict that, number one, because we don't know how big the state tax impacts will be yet. And then we also don't know the degree to which the federal government will provide states additional money that they could use to make up for some of those revenue losses.
So you point out that some school districts are much more reliant on state funding than others. Can you explain why that is and what it could mean if state support does get scaled back?
So there are a lot of different funding streams types of state aid to school districts, but you know the biggest single type is called equalization aid. It's a form of general school aid. It's money that districts can use for whatever priorities they have. That aid is apportioned to districts in part based on property values. So if you have a district, you know, a rural district or an urban district like the Milwaukee Public Schools that have lower property values, they tend to receive more state aid. And, you know, we think of that, I think it's often thought of by many people as a good thing in that that sort of equalizes what property taxes need to be levied at the local level to, you know, provide a similar amount of spending to educate students. And, you know, starts, you know, evens out some of those differences across rich and poor districts. But obviously, you know, in a moment when we're talking about a potential cut to state aid, a district that is more reliant on that assistance is potentially more exposed to financial challenge.
Some examples of the difference between different districts in terms of how reliant they are on state funding. Your report says that Milwaukee Public Schools, 62.6% of the district's instructional fund is from state aid. Janesville is even higher, 65.7%, whereas districts like Madison, only 23% of their instructional fund is from state funding. Waukesha, 41.6%. So it varies really widely depending on the relative property values of the district. So moving on to another major topic in this report. You talk about the fund balances that districts have, which could help them at least temporarily if they fall on hard times by losing a portion of state aid or having a lot of new expenses because of the crisis. So how much financial cushion do districts generally have?
Looking in terms of fund balances, districts on a statewide basis have added to fund balances, you know, during the economic expansion, and that's a resource that they could potentially draw on when they're faced with an unforeseen financial challenge like COVID-19. But there are a lot of important caveats to what I'm saying there, because these fund balances are not necessarily cash that is sitting in districts' bank accounts. You know, they represent assets minus liabilities at a given point in time. You know, those assets can include property tax payments or state aid or state property tax credit payments that are not necessarily, you know, that are due to the district, but not necessarily in hand. Their fund balances can include assets that are restricted and they can't necessarily use for any purpose. And then finally, fund balances are, you know, one-time sources of money and assets. And so, you know, if a district is facing a ongoing cut to its state aid or an ongoing new expenditure need, it can't necessarily, you know, resolve that issue by drawing on, you know, that permanent issue by drawing on a one-time source of funds.
So even though there are a lot of caveats with the fund balances, you know, it's not just money in the bank that can be used for whatever the district wants, you thought it was important to take a look at the picture for district fund balances in the state. And you found a lot of variation in terms of what districts have in their fund balance. And one of the outliers was Milwaukee Public Schools. What's going on there and what could it mean for MPS?
Obviously, MPS is one of the districts that we watch for a number of reasons. It's the state's largest and also has a number of underserved students. When you look at MPS, obviously it's heavily dependent on state aid, which is, you know, there are questions about, you know, what will happen with state aid. And then when you look at its fund balance, MPS has, as a share of its overall spending, its fund balance is one of the smallest in the state and one of the smallest among large districts. So obviously that's a point of concern as we look at this crisis and we see all the financial shocks that could be, you know, that are already happening to districts and that might intensify over the next year.
Do you have those numbers in front of you, the percent fund balance that MPS has compared to some of the other districts? And if you have an average number statewide?
The balance in sort of the instructional funds in MPS and the share of that, the share of spending that represents, MPS before the crisis, MPS was budgeting a fund balance for June 30th that would be roughly 3% spending in the instructional funds. When you look at total fund balances for all districts statewide, that share of spending is more like 24%. You know, it's significantly less than other districts statewide, and MPS is reporting a significant share of its fund balance as being restricted or otherwise set aside, which means that there could be limitations even on the modest balance that it has.
Right. So MPS is kind of operating on a shoestring fund balance there, 2-3% compared to around 20% for other districts on average.
Right. You know, when you look at it in terms of just in terms of dollars, it's $32 million. And so I think to a lot of listeners, that sounds like, you know, a really big number. And, you know, obviously in some senses it's significant. But, you know, given the size of MPS and, you know, the size of their annual spending, that's pretty modest, you know, when you put it in that context.
Right. And MPS Superintendent Keith Posley has released his budget proposal for the upcoming school year, but it doesn't take into account any financial changes due to the coronavirus. And it also does not account for $57 million from the recent referendum, which you also mentioned in your report could be a major help for the district during this time of financial uncertainty. So more details on the MPS budget will hopefully come out at a school board budget meeting Thursday night. And it'll be interesting to see how the conversation goes with all of this uncertainty about revenue and expenses. You point out that this pandemic is going to increase students' and families' needs, and I think everyone recognizes what a huge disruption this has been to education, an unprecedented disruption. And it's going to be, you know, something that school districts might want to pay for additional programming to help students get back on track academically or help with, you know, emotional mental health concerns. But with the uncertain financial picture, including state funding, you point out that districts may just have a hard time even maintaining status quo.
Yes, I mean, that is one of the ironies here. So obviously, as districts have had classroom teaching affected here and have had to shift to virtual instruction, there's obviously, and we don't fully know, but there's obviously some impacts to student outcomes. And there might be a lot of things that districts would like to do to minimize or address those impacts going forward that might carry a cost, whether that would be additional instruction in the summer or other things, right? And obviously, one of the challenges here is that it may be difficult to sustain current operations depending on what happens in the coming months and let alone, you know, taking on, you know, some of these new responsibilities that local leaders and local communities might want to undertake.
Jason Stein is research director at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He spoke with WUWM's Emily Files about a new report detailing the financial uncertainty school districts are facing during the pandemic. On Thursday, Milwaukee Public Schools has its first hearing on a proposed budget for the upcoming school year, and you can find more about it at WUWM.com. Coming up next, how the coronavirus has reawakened some longstanding debates on the nature of our government. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The coronavirus pandemic has invigorated debates around civil rights and democracy across America. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a coalition of conservative activists are petitioning the state Supreme Court for a second time to overturn safer at home directives. The activists say Governor Evers' limits on gatherings infringe on their rights to religion and assembly. To check in on how these debates square with historical conceptions of freedom in America, Lake Effect's Julian Haida called up Jennifer Fenton, a visiting assistant professor in political theory at Marquette University.
Jennifer Fenton, thank you for joining us on Lake Effect.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm happy to be here.
The first question I wanted to ask you has to do with people who are dissenting to the stay-at-home orders, the safer-at-home orders. There are a lot of protests here in Wisconsin, and they're comparing safer-at-home orders often to tyranny. Now, when I think of tyranny, I think of the Revolutionary War. I think of an oppressive king from across the ocean. When, over the course of American political life, did tyranny come to mean what it is today, which is an expression of government overreach?
how are the people who are using this language to defy stay-at-home orders, you know, sort of what ideological framework are they thinking of? And I think it's important to sort of think about different conceptions of freedom in the history of how Americans have thought about democracy, how democratic theorists have thought about democracy. And so sort of the Enlightenment era of freedom is this conception of like freedom from domination from a monarch, right? And so we introduce checks and balances. But then during the Industrial Revolution, late 19th, early 20th century, a lot of political theorists started thinking about freedom in a more expansive way because they were trying to think about freedom and equality in the context of industrial capitalism. And so industrialism brought this really new way of humans living and working with one another. So you have the rise of the modern city, factories, mass migration to urban landscapes. And so a lot of political theorists early 20th century started thinking about freedom as something that is not just freedom from domination of the state, but the freedom to live a meaningful life. This sort of second wave conception of freedom has focused a lot around community. And this sort of communitarian movement, one of the central claims has been that, you know, love and friendship cannot survive their parties constantly insisting on their rights. And I borrow this from a virtue ethics theorist, like that community is more than just about individuals exercising their rights and their freedom, right? And so I think we have this divide in our country between these sort of two conceptions of freedom.
It feels a lot like the labor movement. The labor movement really rose at the turn of the last century. So when you hear people, you know, using the right to work as a stance in opposition to stay-at-home orders, how does that kind of sit with you in the way that it evokes a kind of labor rights thing?
The focus of the narrative is on the government restricting people's freedom to participate in the economy. Because alternatively, the narrative could be focused on the government's responsibility to be transparent about the decision-making processes, or the government's responsibility to ensure that people have access to healthcare and access to a living wage during this time. But the narrative is shifted towards big bad government instead of I'm a citizen and this government is accountable to me. I think that we need to be really careful about the ways that we insist on individual rights, because too many individual aggregates insisting on their individual rights can actually cooperatively or sort of collectively undermine a public good or a public interest. Some of the way that we use the language of rights is actually introducing practices that individually these people are protecting their right to freedom, but collectively it has the effect of undermining an interest for a group, such as like the ability for unionization efforts to be successful. I mean, it undermines the capacity for unions to be productive.
And I'm wondering if that fits into the kind of the same justification that's used, I deserve to work, without necessarily, for example, taking into account people who also need to work who are immunocompromised and will have even less of an opportunity to work if the people they're supposed to be working with might be harboring the coronavirus.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a political theorist who's, you know, studying deliberative democracy theory, which is a theory of democracy that says democracy isn't just about voting. It's not just about aggregating preferences. It's about discussion with one another to generate a conception of a common good. And so one of the fundamental sort of challenges that we see when we're trying to understand the exercising of individual rights, but also the common good, is that the mere aggregation of people's preferences, the mere exercising of individual rights, does not necessarily produce a common good.
Whereas the argument can be made on both sides of the coronavirus debate that on one hand, staying home and taking economic loss is for the common good, or on the other side, reopening the economy despite the apparently inevitable return of the virus is in the common good because at least people will be employed. So both sides are appealing to a common good, but there's still a lack of kind of common language here. How has that been kind of addressed in this deliberative process?
My worry in sort of a laissez-faire capitalist conception of the common good, the thinking is that, well, every individual having the right to pursue his or her own economic interests is in the common good. But that sort of misses something important about what democracy is about. I mean, democracy is about people working together to define a public interest. It's not about people working individually to pursue their own private interests, and then like that is itself in the public good.
It seems like some people believe that, though. I mean, there's a yes. whole stock belief in that.
Yes, they do. And I think the worry is that that is not how you successfully solve problems in any organization. I mean, just imagine if you're just a small organization and everyone is just furthering what they think is the interest of the organization, or maybe even some of them are furthering their own private personal interests. Right? So the fallacy in sort of the laissez-faire capitalist conception of a common good is that a bunch of individuals pursuing their own private interests will necessarily create a good society. And but to take this even further, the real worry for myself as a democratic theorist who's interested in social justice is that this will also not produce a just society. Because justice is about defining a good for everyone.
In other words, you're afraid that people will self-organize in a manner that is inherently unequal. But some people say that, well, inequality is natural.
Yes, I mean, that is sort of the narrative that we're seeing in our society. And we've seen this narrative, I mean, this narrative has been alive and well for hundreds of years.
We see all this opposition to safer at home, stay at home orders. They've spread all over the country. We've talked a little bit about some of them, and they seem to be self-organized. Now, I've also seen some people invoke the term astroturfing, which gets to how they might have been organized. What is astroturfing, and why might people suspect their involvement in these anti-quarantine protests?
So astroturfing is referring to sort of a fake grassroots movement. So rather than real grass, it's astroturf. But so it's used in online communities, especially on the Reddit platform, to refer to coordinated and centralized efforts to design online infrastructures that give the illusion of a grassroots movement. So, what will frequently happen is that Facebook groups will emerge, and people will join these Facebook groups thinking that they are local community members who are organizing a group around an ideology or a value or a movement that they care about. But really, they're coordinated and centralized efforts. And there have been some allegations that this has been the source of the anti-quarantine protests that have been happening throughout the country. So I will tell you, Saturday, April 18th, there was a Redditor account, Dr. Midnight, did some research where he was finding a lot of similar domains linked to the websites that organized these Facebook protests. And then the following Monday and Tuesday, the news started picking up on this.
And when it seems like a grassroots movement, news editors, journalists such as myself, feel a need to cover these things, even though they might be smaller than we perceive them to be, correct?
Yeah, they may be smaller, but I think a lot of times we focus on the size, like, oh, the movements aren't as large as, you know, they look, right? But astroturfing does something really important. It sort of plays on some of the cultural meanings that are attached to grassroots movements. And it manipulates those cultural meetings for its purpose. And what I mean by that is there's cultural meanings tied to grassroots protesting because it sort of stands as a symbol to us that, oh, wow, here's a group of disenfranchised people who are bringing forward this claim to the community for their own interest as an underrepresented and disenfranchised community. It has that cultural meaning, that cultural value. And so an organization that stands to profit from this could fabricate grassroots organizing in order to give the public perception that this is an authentic expression of the will of disenfranchised people. One of the concerns about astroturfing is that not only does it fabricate a grassroots movement, but it also gives the movement the narrative. The narrative doesn't generate organically from a group of people. It's planted. It's a way of framing the issue that's planted in the movement efforts.
That was Jennifer Fenton, a visiting assistant professor in political theory at Marquette University, speaking with Lake Effect's Julian Haida. Her comments on astroturfing in Wisconsin are backed up by reporting in the Washington Post and Minneapolis Star Tribune. You can see links to that and more at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect that's right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, so stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.